Paul Pedrosa received his BA in creative writing right here at the University of Texas, El Paso. And he received an MFA in fiction from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Currently, he teaches in the English department at New Mexico State University. He has been published in Rattle, Make, a Chicago literary magazine, Palabra, Border Senses, and many, many more. This is his first book. Paul, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be on the show.
Well, it's great to finally have you on the show. I've known you for a long time. You were a creative writing major as an undergraduate here at UTEP. I think you had had me for more than one or two workshops. Why did you major in creative writing? I mean, when did you know you wanted to be a writer that you would immediately come into the university and major in creative writing?
You know, actually, I didn't major in creative writing to begin with. I started off as a print media major, which is totally archaic now.
Wow. Yeah, that's good then, because you would have no job. Not that the opportunities come for creative writers, but yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, out of high school, I was always interested in writing, interested in communicating. And I thought, when I started at UTEP, I thought that journalism was going to be the perfect fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
But little by little, I drawing on my interest in reading and in, you know, crafting stories from when I was younger, and also in an interest to have more control over what I write, you know, the ownership of my writing.
Right, right. So you can go into roads that weren't necessarily factual or thematically fit into the piece.
Right. And I have to pretend to be, you know, impossibly objective.
Because we know anytime you you write words, no matter what, how objective you think you are, your perspective is certainly slanting the story in a particular way.
Exactly. So, you know, I just, not that the communication program was bad or I wasn't enjoying it. It just seemed to not fit quite as well for me as time moved on. So I decided to take a class in creative writing, sign up as a major. And actually, I took intro to creative writing with you. So you were my first workshop.
Oh,
leader.
No wonder you turned out so good. I'm only joking. You were in my intro to creative writing class, and then you took probably everybody that was here, all the professors in various classes, including Ben Sines and Rosa and Jeff.
Leslie Allman, Lex Williford, yeah. It was great. It was a great program. I learned a great deal from my undergrad experience in creative writing.
In retrospect, do you think that your years as an undergraduate at UTEP in the creative writing department, do you think during all those years you wrote something that was pretty good?
it's not a reflection on the quality of my instructors, but it was certainly a growing experience. None of it really exists today, I guess.
There's not a single story in this new book of yours that you wrote as an undergrad?
No, no. The oldest, which is A Man Who Ate His Own Head, I wrote that maybe a year or two after I completed my degree.
I didn't start writing fiction as an undergrad. I started as a graduate student because my degree was in political science, but I took 2 or 3 years to get a master's in English really as an excuse to take creative writing courses. And so that represents to me my undergraduate years. And I don't think anything I wrote during those years made it into ultimate print or into a book. And maybe there's something about those first years where you just need to write and write and write and get it all out and find your voice?
I completely agree. And even the rough draft of that particular story is completely different from the finished product. So I think it is just, it's a growing experience. It takes time. You don't necessarily produce great stuff, you know, in the beginning years. I mean, if you do, I know a few people who have, you know, more power to them, but I think more common experience is that slow growth.
It starts off really with that artistic impulse, like a band, for example. A band should probably be playing in the garage for a couple of years before they get on stage in front of thousands of people.
Great, great analogy. I totally agree. those are my garage days.
Yeah. The Dead Will Rise and Save Us, stories by Paul Pedrosa. This is your first book. Congratulations. It's a beautiful book. And I don't mean just the stories. I know these stories very well because I've read them multiple times. But physically, the book, which is put out by Velice Books, a new publication, looks really, really beautiful. And you have been working on this for a long time, I know, because you got your MFA, I think, at the University of Illinois?
Yes.
You had to have an outside reader on your thesis, and I was that outside reader, and that's the first time I read this manuscript. It's been in the making for a long time. Tell us about the process, how it came about, and how many years it took.
Well, first, I want to thank you for the kind words about the project. You know, I'm very happy with Release Books, and the publishers are great, and I'm very excited to see what the future holds for not only the press, for myself. But yeah, the process, about half the book is roughly 7 years old. You know, as a student, I was intending to work on a novel for my thesis project, but that didn't work out because of logistics. It was tough to expect fellow students to be able to keep up with the novel project and workshop. So I turned to stories, some of the stories that I used for my application packet, and, you know, just try to sort of ground myself in the border region, because I knew I wanted to write border stories and focus on disparate lives but sort of different sorts of outlier types. It was a growing experience. It was fun. It was challenging. Having to justify certain choices because, you know, I happen to be a border writer to people who aren't familiar with border writing was also a necessary growing experience, even if there were growing pains every once in a while.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I am from Fresno, and Fresno is very similar to El Paso in many ways. A majority of the people are poor. There's a large Latino community. It's not an overly educated city. There's really only one major university there. And there's a lot of, you called them outliers, and I'm not quite sure if you're referring to outliers in the term that Maxim Gladwell would use it as, you know, those who kind of think and are able to, you know, see things differently, or if you mean like dispossessed, you know, those that are just living in an alternate kind of culture, an alternate economy. But there's a lot of that in Fresno, too. And when I went to University of Oregon, which was, you know, hills and rain and very few Latinos, 7%, I think, of the whole population were Latinos. I really saw Fresno from a different way. I really got perspective about my home, and I felt myself writing all these Fresno stories. And I imagine when you went to Indiana, a landscape so completely from the one that you grew up in, from the border, from El Paso and Juarez, it must have allowed you to see it in a different way?
I mean, that's absolutely my experience. You know, it was so different. There was a great deal of culture shock. Being in the middle of cornfields, and it really, though, did allow for me to develop that distance that I needed to kind of get out of the middle of it, mm-hmm. of El Paso, and reflect. You know, it was a necessary time for reflection.
Yeah.
And then eventually we came back to the region, and it was the perfect time to come back. But I think these stories would either be completely different or not exist at all if it wasn't for that opportunity for distance.
Absolutely.
And You're absolutely right about the Gladwell point of view of what I mean by outliers, you know, the dispossessed, the people who need to transverse certain political or physical boundaries.
Right, right. Well. Yeah, and the border life here in El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, there are so many extreme contradictions, you know, not just between rich and poor, but I'm wondering, having grown up here and then having left for a while and seen your home from a different way, but as a writer, because you're writing stories, if some of the metaphors of the border just jumped out at you in ways that hadn't before, and you go, oh my God, that is just so symbolic.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, it goes back to the distance. And when I was a grad student, I worked with Richard Powers, and we had a conversation about it, and he named it so perfectly. He expressed that the border area between the United States and Mexico is the last bit of contested territory in this nation. And being able to look at it from afar, you know, the time period that I spent away in Illinois was when the drug cartel violence really picked up.
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel both the physical wall that at that point was being built, but you also feel the metaphoric wall between the two nations just, you know, strengthen and grow larger in imagination. And right. Anytime I came back to visit, you know, there was a different feel.
I moved here before the drug wars and was here during all of them. And yeah, it definitely is a different feel going into Juarez, for example, like before the drug wars, when, you know, we can go into Juarez and spend the day there and feel completely at ease. Yeah, there was a different feeling, even if it's something that we're bringing our own perspective. But the fact is, it did change a lot. And I'm wondering if when it was going on, if saying you were from El Paso, Juarez, gave you a little street cred.
Well, I think the biggest effect on everyday conversation I had with people, they were asking pretty big questions about violence in El Paso. Right. You have to make the distinction a lot of the times.
Isn't it a pleasant distinction to make, to tell people El Paso is one of the safest cities in the country? I mean, because the assumption is that it's really dangerous, but yeah, it really is a very, very safe city.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I would make that distinction, and I think most people would believe me. I think some people kind of, you know, squinted at me a little bit. You know, have to bust out the statistics.
I'm talking to Paul Pedrosa. His first collection of stories is called The Dead Will Rise and Save Us. And it's a book you've been working on for a long time. Was it easy to get it published?
The final stage when I connected with Lelis Books was about as easy as I can imagine the process being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's once you got a publisher. Was it hard to get one? Was it a process that became frustrating? I know a lot of writers, right out of their MFA, after a couple of years, just give up because first 2 years they can't get published.
Yeah, absolutely. It was frustrating in different ways. You know, I was longlisted for a contest. I was rejected by certain presses saying they enjoyed it, but no thanks. And it was actually accepted by another press, and I had issues with that press, and it was very frustrating, and I ended up withdrawing it. So the process before actually finding the publisher, yes, it was pretty trying, to say the least.
The fact is, there are a lot of good books out there, like yours. I think your book is a fantastic book, and if you don't believe me, just look at the back cover and see what I wrote about it. Could have been published by any of the publishers that you've submitted to, and they would have been proud of it. But in any part of the process, and I'm asking you this because I know there's a lot of writers that listen to this show and can get discouraged easily. At any point in the process, did you quit believing in the book itself and start thinking, well, maybe I'm not a writer. Maybe the stories aren't any good?
Never to that extent. I've always believed in my stories, believed that they had value, you know, but on the basis of having to work hard at them. I think my lack of confidence is more on the publishing end of things. Like maybe I wasn't so sure about how well I could do it, how well I could sell the book.
Right.
But that's not to say that, I mean, of course, every writer goes through this.
Right.
You know, you wonder whether it's worth it. You know, it's such a long struggle. And this took years for me, a few years for me to produce. So I almost shelved it a couple of times.
Right. You start off the book, The Dead Will Rise and Save Us, stories by Paul Pedrosa, with a quote from T.S. Eliot. It says, "I will show you fear in a handful of dust." What does this quote mean to you? Why does this quote open the book?
You know, it goes back again to what I mentioned briefly about, you know, these outliers, these like Flannery O'Connor type characters who struggle, who are often poor, who have to scratch and claw their way to contentment, to happiness. And it ties into the idea of the desert being habitable and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And when you learn to love the desert, it's a hard-earned love.
Wow, I like that. Yeah, that's beautiful.
It's not like, you know, a lush, green, beautiful environment. That's an easy love. You know, but learning how to love the desert, to appreciate what it gives and what it takes, is difficult. And so that quote, when I found it as I was working on the manuscript, it was perfect. It was perfect timing to come across that.
You know, you talked about, as you were working on it, you found that quote. I know there's a lot of writers who have pictures, or a picture, a single picture, sometimes more, of writers they admire hanging by their desk or in their workspace. Is there anybody that you have hanging above your workspace? And if not, who would you have hanging there?
Well, the man that is hanging, I do have an author hanging in my workspace, and that's, of course, Franz Kafka.
Oh, awesome. Why Kafka?
Well, he's a huge influence on this particular book for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the self is sort of isolated and sort of self-punishing and sort of ostracizing his or herself from everyone. It's been a big influence to me. And other writers I would hang above my workspace, definitely Flannery O'Connor, I'd mention there, for much the same reasons. You know, those characters, the sort of those disparate lives that still share this sort of, you know, feeling of otherness.
Right. Yeah, that seems to be an important theme in your fiction. And if you were to put pictures side by side of Franz Kafka and Flannery O'Connor, probably most people would say, but they were so unlike. You know, Flannery O'Connor, you know, being a very conventional character-based writer of short fiction, then Kafka being a creator of what we now call the Kafkaesque, and to really kind of transcend, you know, the limits of the narrative. But they're similar in terms of their characters, and Kafka's characters oftentimes are, of course, very close to him, and so are Flannery O'Connor's, I imagine, are just so full of desire and so full of need that'll probably never get satisfied. Would you say your characters are like that?
Definitely many of the characters in this book. Certainly, I feel a closeness with the focal character of the first story, Subtle Shades of Green. That's pulled a little bit from my experience, you know, fictionalized in the distance, but Peter, my homeless character that appears in three stories throughout the collection, mm-hmm. is another one. You know, just these characters who I think the most common denominator among all of these characters is that they do have a tendency to know themselves fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a struggle to achieve that.
You are no doubt an El Paso writer. You are a border writer. You are a Southwest writer. You are an American writer. You are a writer of the Americas. But there's certain stories that are in this book that are just so El Paso. And that's definitely one of them. And it has to do with a theme that you don't often see in books in a lot of the border Chicano literature. And it has to do with the main character being, well, a little bit too white. Can you explain how this story came about? And why that theme is important to you?
Well, you know, so my background, you know, my dad is Mexican, my mom is white. And so growing up, going to school, and this especially was common in middle school, you know, my experience was fairly common in the city. If you happen to be Mexican, but, you know, you have a lighter complexion, you have hazel eyes, you know, lighter hair, whatever it happens to be, you tend to, at least back in my day, I'm not so sure how it is now, you tend to attract, you know, certain comments, you know, and you sort of put a little bit on the defensive, you know, just like the character in the story, you know, he says, I'm Mexican, my last name is, you know, Mendez, in my case, my last name is Toto. So there's, you know, some experiences that I had growing up, you know, where you sort of, whether you like it or not, you put on the defensive a little bit, and so it's you know, it's like defending yourself and your place in the greater context of a school or an area, region, what have you. And so, you know, so that's the struggle of this character who also happens to come from a working class family,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't see the privilege that he's accused of having.
Right. Who's being encouraged by his counselors when his counterparts with darker skin are not. And he's not sure, well, are they encouraging me because I'm lighter skinned, or are they encouraging me because I deserve it? You know, I remember one time when I moved to rural Minnesota to take a position at a university, Southwest State University in Marshall, that it was about a 3-hour drive from the Twin Cities, passing through these little tiny towns with populations like 1,000, 1,500. And I remember driving through one of these towns. It's surrounded by cornfields, and at the edge of town was a schoolyard, and school was in session, and the little elementary kids were running around, and they were all, you know, very pale, you know, white, blonde-haired, or even black-haired kids, And then among them, I saw these two really dark, dark Mexican kids really stand out. And I thought, well, that must be quite an experience for them to grow up, you know, in that kind of otherness, you know, just physically the otherness. And that's what you're writing about in this story, in a sense, is that it takes place at Bowie High, which is right on the border. And I'm wondering, is that theme important to you as a Chicano writer, but to give it a different kind of take?
Absolutely. I'm very much, as I've mentioned a few times now, I'm interested in that sense of otherness. It's sort of living on the fringe, whether by choice or by force. And so, I do feel that this story is emblematic of that, and sort of in that atmosphere of, you know, this daily harassment of students by immigration in and around the school campus, I thought was a great place to start. And to start also characterizing El Paso in that way and sort of setting the table for that, to bring about that presence of that otherness.
Right.
You know, to look at perspectives that maybe aren't so common when writers write about the area.
Well, I'm talking to Paul Pedrosa, The Dead Will Rise and Save Us, a collection of stories. And I mentioned the first story. We were talking about the first story, Subtle Shades of Green, as a very El Paso, thematically a very El Paso story. Also, even in terms of the landscape and themes. And all the stories really, there's even one story called El Paso, but all the stories really kind of reflect this region. And the title story, The Dead Will Rise and Save Us, is a really interesting story. And it visually perhaps was inspired by these grave markers that we always see along the highway in the desert and throughout the city. Can you tell us about how this story came about and why you organized it the way you did?
Well, the inspiration for the story, it's kind of a funny story. So one year I was back home visiting family, and I was in my stepdad's truck. He and my mom were in the front seat. And we were driving somewhere, probably going to eat or something, and we were passing, here and there, some of these roadside memorials.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were heading to our destination, they were telling stories like, oh, here's where so-and-so died, and here's where so-and-so died, and here's where so-and-so died. And finally, it was happening so much that I told them, I was like, you guys are really morbid, like... telling these stories, and they just stuck with me then. And for years I've seen them, and anywhere, you know, if there's an accident, someone unfortunately passes away in the region, we build monuments, we put favorite items, beer, whatever we identify our loved ones with, you know, as tribute, keeping their memory alive. And when I returned home, I had this vision of a character not only visiting these monuments, but doing it every year and keeping meticulous notes and learning as much as he could about who those people were that passed away, you know, what their lives were, you know, and hoping to avoid to reducing them to, you know, a new story, just being their whole existence defined by their tragic ending. So,
yeah, it's a wonderful premise for the story, and especially because El Paso, you know, we're Mexican in El Paso. Even if we're not Mexican, we're Mexicans. And one of the things that we know about Mexicans, and Lorca even said this, that Mexicans and the Spaniards have a relationship with death like nobody else in the world. Obvious during the drug wars, but nonetheless, we have the Day of the Dead where we make altars for our dead. We don't shy away from it. And so as you were writing that story, I'm wondering, were there moments when you were writing it and you just kind of felt some sort of, for lack of a better word, a connection to the past, a connection to Mexico, a connection to the dead?
I did, absolutely. It's the longest story in the collection, and it's tough in that sense. It was tough to write, but it was tougher to write because of, you know, something you touched upon, just, you know, the presence of death and sort of... I made an effort to be very detailed and have the character be sort of detached from a lot of those details. Mm-hmm. We could play them later, which I won't spoil. But, you know, just thinking about how these memorials are constructed and where they're constructed and, you know, researching, because, again, I was away as I was writing this. I was researching places in the city. And it really just, it made me reflect on, you know, I don't know anyone personally who passed away and had one of these roadside monuments erected in their honor. But, you know, it doesn't seem to matter. I think as a city, you know, we see them, we feel that sense of loss, not as strongly, obviously, as a family, but it affects us. And, right. And then there's even times when the memorial is constructed in a place that someone else finds inconvenient and there's a call for them to be removed, and the city rises up and defends the right for that memorial to remain where it is.
Right. And to paraphrase Garcia Lorca, where death is possible, there you will find the duende. And the book is The Dead Will Rise and Save Us by Paul Pedrosa. Paul, thank you for joining us on Words on the Wire, and best of luck with this book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.